From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a week of relentless anthrax coverage, much of the anxiety has centered on the confusing and contradictory information flowing out of a variety of government offices. Until recently, we heard little from the CDC and the Surgeon General, and hardly at all from the newly created Director of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge. Mostly, we heard from Tommy Thompson, the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, and his grasp on the information seemed to some disconcertingly upbeat. For instance, when Robert Stevens, photo editor at the Florida-based Sun Tabloid, was found to be infected, Thompson opined that he might have contracted it by drinking from a stream. And on another point, just this week, Ted Koppel on Nightline felt compelled to correct him.
And we've been able to respond to the outbreak of anthrax in Florida and in New York and now in Washington, and we've been there. So I don't think that I have been too optimistic. I think that we've been able to respond.
You do realize when you talk about the outbreaks of anthrax,
yes,
you haven't had an outbreak
of anthrax yet.
You haven't had a major anthrax attack yet.
That is true.
I mean, in the event of a
Late this week, Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge finally stepped up to the microphones to calm the public's fears. But some believe the damage to the government's credibility will be hard to repair. Surgeon General David Satcher, appointed by the Clinton administration, was quiet in the early days of the crisis, but has been on the record frequently this week. He joins us now. Dr. Satcher, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Brooke. I'm delighted to be with you.
Anne Smithson, who is a bioterrorism expert at the Henry L. Stimson Center, told the New York Times that one of the lessons drawn from Florida is that the first thing Americans need to hear is a voice that speaks from knowledge, not from hyperbole. The country was attacked and traumatized on September 11th, but the scars created in recent weeks may actually be much more difficult to recover from.
I would be very concerned if people felt that they were being intentionally misled. I don't think Secretary Thompson has made any attempt to mislead anybody. He is a very positive person, and he has rightfully, I think, tried to do his part to say to the American people, stay calm, don't panic. Anthrax is certainly not contagious, but as somebody said, fear of anthrax can be so contagious that it can really disrupt the entire system of public health. You know, most of us who go through training in public health, it takes us a long time to understand the nature of screening tests and percent, you know, false positive and predictability of tests. All of those things are very important in understanding how to interpret a given test. So when you try to communicate that, you just say preliminary, and then you hope that people hear that.
What makes the situation so complicated is that anthrax is not only a national or a potential outbreak of a dangerous disease, but a national security crisis involving an ongoing federal investigation. So how do national security issues affect the health message that you and the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services are trying to send?
I don't know anybody in the public health system who would stand in the way of the criminal justice system in finding out who's doing this. And if that means delaying certain information because it is privileged information for the criminal investigation, I think we support that. And I think that's understandable to people. It is not the typical public health investigation. It is a partnership between public health and justice.
And do you think that that's happened then, that some information may have been delayed?
Well, we have certainly said, and Secretary Thompson has said on several occasions, this is the purview of the FBI, of the Attorney General. It's a part of the criminal investigation, so we're not prepared to talk about strains right now, except to say that they're all sensitive to the antibiotics that we have available to us. But we don't want to get into that. When people say, well, could this have all been made by the same person, et cetera? Well, that kind of information is a part of the criminal investigation.
What do you think about the media's message? It seems to be one of anthrax anxiety, reports of anthrax-related panic, people stockpiling Cipro, TV commentators opining on the dangers.
I don't think the media has been perfect, just as we haven't been.
Can you give me a few examples?
Several people have reported on this whole recent issue about the unusual nature of this organism found in Senator Daschle's office. However, the laboratory at USAMRIT has not yet reported, and it's important to keep that in mind. And until that laboratory reports on the nature of this organism, it is very premature to get people upset and panic about the weaponization of anthrax. And the scientists tried to communicate that it was preliminary tests, but it's not always heard by the media. That doesn't make as great a story.
You conceded that the information flow has been problematic at the beginning of this crisis, and you say that it's getting better. Can you tell me some of the specific ways you think it's getting better, that it's improving?
Well, the reason my deputy, Surgeon General Ken Matsuga, is stationed on Capitol Hill is that that is a part of our response to what happened there, because we have learned how important it is to have that level of expertise on site, so that every time any press conference is done, you know, that level of expertise is right there. We have people there from the CDC. I think that's a step up in our communication.
How do you feel when you see the perpetual logo anthrax anxiety on MSNBC?
I have mixed feelings, because I am of the opinion that a certain level of anxiety is appropriate here, okay? I'm of the opinion that just as we have put the Public Health Service on high alert, the American people do, in fact, need to be on high alert. And we don't need to be doing business as usual when it comes to the way we deal with public health issues. I mean, we have gotten really lax in terms of hand washing, for example. If you don't believe it, just watch people when they go to the bathroom. How we cook foods as to minimize the risk of bacteria surviving the cooking. All of these things could be very critical in dealing with the bioterrorist attack.
Dr. Satcher, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Delighted to be with you.
Dr. David Satcher is the Surgeon General of the United States.
Terrorists rely on publicity to maximize their terror. So it makes sense that they would target the networks. And they did, sending anthrax first to Tom Brokaw at NBC, then to ABC, and then CBS News. The pathogenic letters arrived hard upon similarly infectious missives sent to the offices of The Sun and the National Enquirer tabloids, resulting in the death of Sun photo editor Bob Stevens. More recently, anthrax has also been found at the New York Post. By targeting the media, the terrorists have generated some nervous news reporting, OTM's producer-at-large Mike Pesca reports.
Sometime in late September, a letter arrived in the offices of NBC News contaminated with a substance that proved to be anthrax. On Friday, October 12th, the man to whom the letter was addressed took to the airwaves.
Good evening. Tonight we find ourselves in the unusual and unhappy position of reporting on one of our beloved colleagues, a member of my personal staff who has contracted a cutaneous anthrax infection. That's an infection of the skin that is...
Thus began one of the strangest chapters in the history of broadcasting. The news becoming the news is nothing new, but usually the process flows through the channels of publicists and chat show bookers. This was different. Over the last week, the headquarters of the major broadcast networks each became crime scenes, and employees or their relatives became victims. That's how NBC reporter David Bloom came to report back to Tom Brokaw the contents of Brokaw's own mail.
Tom, tonight law enforcement sources tell NBC News that while there was no return address on that suspicious envelope dated September 25th, it did have a postmark from St. Petersburg, Florida.
The reports on NBC on the day that the infection was announced were like looking into a hall of mirrors.
Andrew Tyndall monitors and analyzes network news for a newsletter called The Tyndall Report. The funhouse effect did not distract him from the fact that Bloom's report emphasized the wrong letter. Investigators had been focusing on an envelope with a St. Petersburg postmark, when in fact the anthrax actually came in a letter postmarked Trenton. To Tyndall, this suggested that NBC relied on an unnamed outside source. There was nothing to indicate that they had obtained confirmation from within their own security staff and management.
When the information you get from blind investigative sources turns out to be wrong, and you have your own internal resources to corroborate, the NBC reporter was not using that piece of extra information that the people in the offices at NBC News would have had, or maybe they should have had or could have had.
Of course, no NBC employee may have noted the postmark before turning it over to the authorities. But even if NBC did know, independently corroborating the postmark would only have been possible if the network had traded on its status as a crime scene. Former president of NBC News, Reuven Frank, says it would be improper for NBC to use access it wouldn't have if it were reporting on any prominent U.S. corporation besides NBC.
In a situation like this, a public health situation, a news organization should act as a company rather than as a news organization. Whatever happens, it should be publicly announced, then all the news organizations should use it together.
This is clearly the tack that all the networks are taking. The president of ABC News announced the anthrax in their office in a press conference that wasn't even carried live on ABC. Rick Kaplan is a fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Until last year, he was the president of CNN. He says that even when they are the news, news organizations should be news organizations.
It is much more sensitive when you're reporting on yourself than when you're reporting on someone else. But does that mean you drop it? I don't think so. I think it means you are especially vigilant about telling people completely what your sourcing is, what the details are. I think it's just a matter of just saying, look, you know, this is a news story. We're going to cover it. Same rules apply. Let's just get it right.
It's unquestionably a unique position to be in, where we are reporting on anthrax cases throughout the nation, and many of us are taking Cipro.
Dan Abrams has been covering the anthrax story primarily for MSNBC. He's on Cipro because he also works out of NBC's Rockefeller Center offices. He's not bothered that certain details, like the name of Tom Brokaw's infected assistant, appeared in the newspapers before NBC itself reported the information.
There's no question that some of my bosses knew more and know more about this anthrax scare at NBC than I do. There's almost, I think, been a kind of Chinese wall erected. I don't know a whole lot more than what I'm reporting. Sure, did I know the name of the woman initially? Yeah. Did we report it? No. There have been other cases, many other cases, where I've known the name of a particular victim in a case, and as a matter of policy, we decided not to report it.
To Abrams, the real challenge, one he thinks NBC is handling well, is to emphasize that his network is but part of a larger story. This was made apparent throughout the week as anthrax was detected in national and state government offices, as well as in the offices of all network newscasts. CBS took the unusual step of offering their evening news anchor Dan Rather as spokesman during the news conference discussing their own case of anthrax.
Forgive us if you must, but, you know, we're in the news business, and I'm trying to report this as straight up as I would any other story.
Which, of course, is all but impossible because this isn't any other story, especially if you're acting like a company and not a news organization. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Coming up, media companies see a silver lining in disaster. Also, news we could have used, and your letters.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For decades, major broadcasters have lobbied in Washington for deregulation, especially those regulations limiting a media company's size and market coverage. In recent years, in television, radio, cable, and wireless, those companies have had substantial success. Media ownership is now heavily concentrated among a few giant corporations, and the current Federal Communications Commission has signaled its willingness to loosen the rules still more. Now, at least one corporation has found a novel pretext. In a speech to investment analysts at a conference sponsored by Goldman Sachs, Viacom President Mel Karmazin suggested that the first war of the 21st century spells opportunity.
We need to have some more. And those of you that follow the media world know that after the Gulf War in 1991, there was a whole wave of deregulation, starting with radio duopoly to allow two FMs in the same market, you know, then ultimately to the telco bill, which caused a whole lot of relaxation. So we think that there is an opportunity for there to be some further deregulation, which will benefit our industry.
Karmazin also surveyed the economic hardships suffered by smaller media properties and managed to see past the travails of their owners.
If, in fact, there is a silver lining from a business point of view, it's because, you know, some of our competitors are not as strong.
Joining us now is Jeffrey Chester. He's executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington. Jeff, we just listened to Mel Karmazin at the Goldman Sachs conference. Did he say what I thought he said?
He said two things. One, that there's a bright side in what's happened after September 11th, because there's now a downturn in the media economy, and there are a lot of media properties out there that could be swallowed up for good prices by a Viacom CBS. But he also said in order to do so, the federal government has to get rid of all the remaining ownership safeguards that prevent a Viacom or an AOL from buying up all these properties.
So opportunity knocks. There's a bunch of bargains out there. If only the government would relax the rules allowing companies like Viacom to snap them up. He's not asking for a direct bailout in the way that the government gave tens of billions in cash to the airlines.
Well, but what Karmazin is asking for is for the public to award him media properties that in essence are worth many billions more than we've just given the airline industry.
One thing that Karmazin told his audience was that there is some precedent for the notion of regulatory relief in the wake of war. He said that the previous round of broadcast industry deregulation happened in the environment immediately after the Persian Gulf War. Is his memory right? Is that how it shook out?
I think we should be glad that Mr. Karmazin is just a broadcast executive and not an historian. He's flatly wrong. There was no relationship between the television's industry coverage of the Gulf War and the subsequent deregulation, which happened several years later. Clearly, in Mr. Karmazin's mind, though, there needs to be a quid pro quo for the media industry's coverage of this war.
Isn't there in the whole licensing process, though, the assumption that broadcast networks, as licensees of public airwaves, have a responsibility in the first instance to provide some level of public service? Isn't that part of the deal going in?
The bedrock of the Communications Act is that the broadcasters receive this very valuable license to broadcast that literally brings the broadcasting industry $30 billion a year in revenues. They get these free licenses because they're supposed to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And that really boils down, for the most part, to providing news.
In terms of getting bailouts or regulatory relief, though, from Washington, isn't it kind of like take a number? There's other industries that are far more desperately affected by the post-September 11th environment than the TV networks. How much sympathy can these guys generate on Capitol Hill?
I think that they are quite likely to achieve what they hope to get. You have an administration, particularly the new Bush administration Federal Communications Commission chair, Michael Powell, who is very sympathetic already to further media deregulation. And now the networks can say, look, my God, you know, we've lost money. We're providing an important public service. We ourselves are targets. The communications economy is very important in this country. Give us these deregulatory policies. So I think there's a real danger that we will lose these public interest safeguards, and the industry will be able to walk away with additional billions of dollars.
Jeff Chester, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy.
Last weekend, Osama bin Laden's organization released another taped statement, but chances are you didn't see it. The U.S. cable news and broadcast networks were complying with a request from National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to review the tapes and to reconsider broadcasting them. On Monday, the British government called a meeting with the heads of that nation's largest news outlets, the BBC, ITN, and Sky News. At that meeting, Alistair Campbell, the Prime Minister's communications director, made the same request that Rice presented to the U.S. networks. Alan Rusbridger, editor of The Guardian in London, joins us now to discuss the British media's reaction. Hello there.
Hello.
Now, the three networks issued a statement that went like this. As responsible broadcasters, we are mindful of national and international security issues and the impact reports can have in different communities and cultures, but we will retain the right to exercise our own independent, impartial editorial judgment. So was that a no, or was that a trust us?
Well, I think it was saying, we hear what you say, we understand your concerns, now get lost. We're the broadcasters. This isn't, none of these are state broadcasting institutions. And do us the credit of acknowledging that we have some experience in these fields and we'll take the decisions.
Now, do you think one of the reasons why the networks refused in a body to consider the guidance of government in this matter is because they faced similar issues in the past? Back in 1988, Margaret Thatcher put a media-wide ban on showing any member of the IRA on television in England.
They could show their faces, but they weren't allowed to listen to their voices. So the voices had to be dubbed by actors. And I think, in truth, it had absolutely no impact at all beyond perhaps turning them into a rather mysterious and glamorous figures.
I still find it a little peculiar that she would permit the faces and she would permit the words. She simply wouldn't permit the faces to speak the words.
Well, it was a ridiculous restriction, and I think many people felt so at the time, but she couldn't stomach it personally. She had friends that were blown up by the IRA, murdered by the IRA, and she found it personally deeply offensive to find these people speaking on the news. The most hopeful thing about the last 5 years has been that we can now engage with Sinn Féin on a level where there is a political dialogue. In the end, argument is the only thing that's going to win, and that is certainly what has transpired in Ireland, and we have to understand where the Irish nationalists are coming from in order to be able to talk to them and negotiate with them. And I personally feel the same about bin Laden, that he is a man who understands us better than we understand him, and it is nothing but good to be exposed to him so that we can at least see where he's coming from.
How much control does the British government have over the British media? Can it impose bans if it wants to now?
I think governments now are alert enough to realizing that it just looks bad if you try to come down heavy-handedly on news organizations. I mean, there's a strange thing in Britain called a D-notice committee, which is a voluntary system by which journalists can ring up this admiral and say, we're thinking of publishing this or this. Can you advise me on whether it's going to be harmful to the national interests?
National interest or national security?
Either. And the admiral will give a view, and it's a sort of slightly antiquated, potentially sinister process, which has probably seen its day, but that is the nearest that we have to any kind of official government control.
During the Falklands War, I understand Mrs. Thatcher again asked the BBC and the other networks to refer to British forces as our forces. How did that fly?
I don't think that played well at all, and I'm not sure that any broadcasting institution abided by that.
I could go on and name a variety of other times when the British government has complained or criticized about reporting, especially international reporting, but these are all criticisms. Do you think that the British government has pretty much kept hands off?
I sense it's a kind of weary ritual that they feel obliged to go through in the hope that it will concentrate the minds of the editors. I don't think they ever think it's going to have any real effect.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I hope that was useful.
Alan Rusbridger is editor of The Guardian. We heard over and over again, it was a shock and a surprise what happened on September 11th. We could not have anticipated it, nor defended ourselves against it. Yes, we were told our intelligence agencies had some warning of an attack, but without knowing the crucial where, when, and how, much less the why, there was nothing they could do about it. But is that entirely true? Since 1999, a team chartered by Congress called the U.S. Commission on National Security in the 21st Century has attempted to penetrate the American consciousness with warnings that we were at risk from precisely the sort of attack we have sustained, right down to the risk to skyscrapers. But when the commission shopped its findings around to America's great newspapers and the networks, the response was less than the commissioners had hoped. Les Gelb, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, was a member of that commission. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In January, you had a good slice of the nation's print and electronic media assembled in a Senate hearing room to hear your findings. Findings, I should say, that were put together by a wide array of former military and intelligence officials, ambassadors, foreign policy experts, politicians, and journalists. Do you think you got a fair hearing?
No. In fact, I don't think almost anybody, public policy schools at universities or think tanks dealing with foreign affairs, has had much of a hearing from the media about anything to do with the substance of policy for a long time. So, frankly, I wasn't surprised when we issued our report with all its alarming elements that the press, by and large, ignored it. You know, interestingly, Brooke, the public didn't ignore it. I don't know the exact figure, but there were well over 1 million hits on the public website of the commission to look at that report.
But none of the networks covered it. CNN
did. Not so far as I can remember, no.
There was a reasonably good response on the Washington Post and the L.A. Times.
That's right.
But fighter pilot William Boyd, a four-star general who was on the commission, told one reporter that he watched in disbelief as the New York Times reporter left before the briefing was even over.
Well, since I don't see very well, I didn't see that. But if Chuck said it, his eyesight is pretty good.
Now, you're a former editor of the New York Times op-ed page. You're a longtime Times man. Can you speculate on what was going on there?
I don't think it's special to the Times. In fact, I think the Times still reports more on substance than you'll find at any other newspaper in the United States. But I think there has been a general decline in the dailies, the weekly magazines, and especially on TV, in substantive reporting on policy issues. I heard from people in the media all the time. Their readers aren't interested in what's going on. My response to that is Americans have never been more involved in the world than they have been the last 10 years. We still have, you know, a $300 billion plus defense budget, troops all over the world, Americans traveling all over the world, and you tell me that Americans have no interest in it? I don't believe it.
Well, it sounds like if you got a million hits on the commission's website, then people did care. Usually, that kind of public interest would inspire coverage, if nothing else, if for no other reason. Why do you think this didn't?
Well, it didn't happen. I think you have to consult my former colleagues for their specific reason. It wasn't for lack of clarity in the commission report or for lack of effort on the part of commissioners to contact the press. And it's not just our commission either, Brooke. There were two other commissions on terrorism, one by the former governor, led by the former governor of Virginia, Gilmore, and another led by the former head of counterterrorism in the State Department, Paul Bremer. Those two commissions said pretty much what we said.
Can we lay the entire blame for inaction on the commission's report on the media?
No. In part, I lay it on ourselves, on the national security experts at universities and think tanks and wherever. And I lay it on myself, too. And I think if I really was prepared to stand 100% behind my words, why wasn't I jumping up and down every day, making a pest out of myself? You know, I think we didn't push the consequences of what we were saying hard enough. So we're responsible, too. And secondly, Congress is also responsible. Congress can create a good focal point for the media if they pay attention to this as well.
Well, Les Gelb, thank you very much.
Okay.
Les Gelb is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And now for a few of your letters. Mark Neymark, writing from Paris, wrote...
Paris?
Well, wait till you hear what he says. Bob's interview with military propaganda expert Jamie Metzl shows the danger of believing one's own propaganda. Metzl recalled a so-called blooper committed by the Iraqi propaganda machine the GIs called Baghdad Betty. Betty is supposed to have warned soldiers about their wives back home fooling around with Bart Simpson, thus demonstrating the difficulty of effectively demoralizing the enemy during wartime. According to the Snopes.com urban legend reference page, this story began as a joke on the Johnny Carson show.
Paris, big deal. Well, monsieur, we checked into this, and here's what we found. Baghdad Betty did exist. No one disputes that. But it seems that Johnny Carson did make the Bart Simpson joke before the news media ever reported it as fact. As recently as last week, both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal reported what we did, that Baghdad Betty told soldiers that their wives were canoodling with Springfield's favorite son. On the Media is in the middle of tracking down various military personnel who claim to have heard this particular utterance first ear. We'll report our findings next week.
And this from Tanju Katalltepe. Apologies, Tanju, but this is why we ask listeners to tell us how to pronounce their names. Tanju emailed us about Rick Davis's report about books made bestsellers by the war on terrorism. Mr. Davis, Tanju writes, refers in passing to the Quran as that collection of often contradictory statements. Not only is this an extremely offensive statement to any Muslim, it is also an expression of ignorance. It is hoped that he benefits from some of the books he was reporting about.
Another interesting letter wasn't intended for us, but was from one fifth grader to another, as reported in The New Yorker. "I am sorry about the crash," the letter begins. "I hope none of your loved ones died. My uncle was a couple of blocks away when it happened, but he is okay. To tell the truth, I really didn't pay attention to the attack until I found out about my uncle. Now I'll even listen to NPR, the most boring radio station in the universe, besides opera. Now I really care what happens. Best wishes, Jane."
Have a comment? Email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. Please include information on where you live and how to pronounce your name, or you may be appalled by what you hear.
Now, music.
Coming up, the young guns at CNN, covering women of cover, and how national security information gets leaked to the press.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For a recent New York Times Magazine piece, writer D.T. Max spent days with White House speechwriters as they prepared for President Bush's rousing address before the joint session of Congress. The resulting article was a fascinating peek into the construction of presidential image, and also a glimpse at the verbal idiosyncrasies of our notoriously unglib president. We spoke to Max recently, mainly to inquire about women of cover, a term that popped up twice in a subsequent news conference. But while we were at it, we wanted to know about the provenance of other Bush-isms, the evil one, smoke them out of their hole, make no mistake. Were these the formulations of image makers or of the president himself?
It really depends on the phrase. If you watch these things closely, you can sometimes trace certain kinds of phrases to certain people in the White House. Crusade, I think, was the president himself. I think it was just something that came out of his mouth. So was make no mistake. I mean, I think it's one of those situations where he perhaps is even thinking, I'm not going to say make no mistake again, and then whoop, out it pops. The other kinds of phrases, and the idea of evil is almost an example of groupthink from the administration. His counselor, Karen Hughes, his chief speechwriter, Mike Gerson, they all really think very much in these terms. They believe, even before the attacks, that America had a purpose in the world that was a moral purpose. I think that's how we got the idea of the Day of Remembrance and Prayer that came after the attacks.
In the primetime news conference that he gave, he referred to women of cover.
I was struck by this, that in many cities, when Christian and Jewish women learn that Muslim women, women of cover, were afraid of going out of their homes alone, that they went shopping with them, that they showed true friendship and support.
First, I thought he had misspoken. He was trying to say women of color, but no, he had clearly, on the second time, said women of cover to refer to Muslim women who wear various kinds of garments covering their faces and their skin to varying degrees. Do you have any idea where that came from?
There are a couple of schools on this. One is that it's along the lines of a return to normalcy. That is to say, we've got a new coinage that may actually become more popular than previous ways of referring to Muslim women. Another possibility just popped out of his mouth. There are a number of ways one can imagine him coming to this, a number of verbal tics that might have been involved. Maybe he was thinking of, as you say, women of color. Maybe it was women of valor. Maybe it was cover girls. I have absolutely no idea. That's a stretch. But in a certain way, it's a kind of wonderful attempt. My editor has described it as Karen Hughes by way of Lanny Guinier. I think the Ford Foundation might have had a hand in that phrase, too. It's kind of wonderfully modern, and we all suspect that there exists somewhere a thesis with that in the title.
In the very same news conference, he talked about coughing up bin Laden. Do you think back, behind the curtain, Karen Hughes and company were wincing or exchanging high fives?
I think that there's a division in the administration, and has been since the attacks, over whether the president should sound like he just rode into Dodge or like he's speaking to the United Nations, so that on the one hand, he'll say, we're going to smoke bin Laden out of his cave, or we want him dead or alive. And then he'll speak about the rights of man in the next moment. It's an oddity.
So do you believe the American public wants our president to speak presidentially, or do you think they want to see the real guy, the genuine article?
I think we all got very nervous. I mean, I think that we were scared. Whatever else may be true, the president has the power to destroy the world. I don't think we want him caught up in his emotions, and I don't think we as Americans really want him as the sheriff. I think we're more comfortable overall with him presiding over the enormous national security and military structure that he does, in fact, preside over. We want bin Laden smoked out of his hole, but we don't really want the president going in there by hand and doing it.
Daniel Max, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel D.T. Max is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine.
As has been noted on this program and elsewhere, war is good for the news business, and in the current case, especially good for CNN. But the reinvigorated cable news pioneer wants to hold on to those numbers after peace breaks out, and it sees a bright future in fresher faces. Joining us now is the always insightful J. Max Robbins of TV Guide. Max, welcome back.
Brooke, it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
So I notice a number of new faces on CNN. Of course, there's a lot of people watching CNN during this crisis. What can you tell us about those faces? What does it mean for the network?
Well, in general, those new faces you see on CNN are younger faces. And maybe some of them have been there a little while, but they're playing a much more prominent role. And that's very deliberate on the part of top management at Turner Broadcasting. It's interesting, for example, Frank Sesno, longtime Washington bureau chief for CNN, is leaving the network. And you're seeing a much younger, square-jawed, more matinee-idol-looking John King at the White House.
And do you think that there's a lot of expertise lost in that shift?
You do see, in some cases, people there you question whether they're there more because they look like they graduated from Dawson's Creek or for their journalistic acumen.
Give me a few more examples of the new faces we've seen.
One guy who's emerged is a guy named Bill Hemmer, who was based in Atlanta. And they moved him up here post-September 11th to anchor some of the daytime coverage. This is a guy who doesn't know New York and has made some real gaffes on the air. But I guess they feel he's easy on the eyes, and they think he has that he's emerging. He's a real talent for the future.
Well, we've been hearing at CNN that they were going to attract more viewers by doing more cheaper talk shows rather than covering the news, and that they were going to hire actors to read the news. There was the famous hire of an actress off of NYPD Blue.
Right. They hired Andrea Thompson to be an anchor on Headline News, and it was part of a whole total makeover for CNN's sister network. And really one of the key architects of that is a guy named Garth Ancier. And Garth Ancier is really a brilliant television programmer. He was one of the architects behind the Fox network when it launched. He was also one of the, well, real prime architect of Dawson's Creek. And he has really been intimately involved with talent, with how things are lit, the whole appearance of CNN and Headline News. It used to be, Brooke, at CNN that they'd say, hey, here the news is the star. Well, that was fine when CNN was a monopoly. But it's not anymore, and it hasn't been for a while. And the harsh reality of the television news business is that people watch personalities.
Why had CNN resisted this notion of network news stars before now? Because it was too expensive to maintain them?
Part of it was cost, and it wasn't in their DNA. They thought that if, you know, we stroke these people, we treat them like stars, they'll become the kind of anchor monsters we've all heard about. Well, yeah, maybe they will be, but I had one person there say to me, hey, you think it's tough dealing with some star anchor power here? You know, we had to deal with Shannon Doherty at the WB. I mean, it's kind of the price you pay to put people in their seats.
And is it working?
It certainly is. Now, look, it's not just the fact that there's more pretty faces on CNN, both male and female. The fact is that they have the most global reach, and they can really kind of outman the other guys. But I think this is part of it, too. I mean, interestingly, right now, in cable, among 18 to 34-year-olds, 18 to 49-year-olds, the most watched network is CNN. 18 to 34-year-olds, it's not MTV, it's not VH1. It's interesting, too, if you watch CNN right now, and they know this, they're running promos, they're running spots for another entity in that same corporate family, they're all under the AOL Time Warner banner, the WB Network. That's key audiences, 18 to 34-year-olds.
That is one of the most amazing crossovers I think I could imagine.
It really is.
I always thought news skewed old.
In normal times, it does. I mean, CNN does extremely well with people 50 and over. But these are not normal times.
Well, Max, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Brooke. Thank you.
Max Robbins writes The Robbins Report for TV Guide.
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th's carnage, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld faced the press to deliver an important message. Not to America, not to the international community, not to the media, but to his own Defense Department. It was a warning about leaking classified information because a leaker, Rumsfeld declared, is a threat.
It's a person who's willing to violate federal criminal statutes and willing to frustrate our efforts to track down and deal with terrorists, and willing to reveal information that could cause the lives of men and women in uniform.
2 weeks later, USA Today ran a page one story detailing U.S. Special Forces operations already proceeding on the ground in Afghanistan. 2 weeks after that, President Bush was so infuriated at leaks from Capitol Hill that he tried to cut off classified briefings to all but a few members of Congress.
Some members did not accept that responsibility. Somebody didn't. So I took it upon myself to notify the leadership of the Congress that I intend to protect our troops.
In the end, the president had to back off because by law, the administration must keep Congress fully informed on intelligence matters. To many inside the Beltway, though, it was the president who seemed to be out of the loop. In Washington, leaking is not only business as usual, it's a way of life.
What the president was saying is, I can't believe that people are getting classified briefings and then leaking information. Come on, Mr. President, it's what happens every day.
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter, author, and founder of the National Security Archive, a repository of declassified information. He says leakers are not only ubiquitous, but necessary to journalism and democracy.
They're correcting things. Sometimes they're verifying things. This is how we get our information. It's an information economy.
And in the information economy, there is never a recession because there are too many journalists chasing too many bureaucrats and politicians with too many reasons to blab. One who reputedly did not blab was Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor in the Clinton administration, and someone known for being maddeningly leak-proof. Firth says that was a matter of integrity and discipline. Discipline, however, diminishes geometrically with each additional individual entrusted with a given piece of information.
You have a small meeting. Everybody in that meeting is extremely responsible, and nobody likes leaks of sensitive information. But they all go back from that meeting to their buildings, and they feel obliged to brief at least one or two other people who are very close to them and important to them operationally. And those people, in turn, brief one or two people who are important to them operationally, and pretty soon you have traversed 6 degrees of separation, and the information has crossed the barrier and is in the public domain.
Beyond carelessness, a main category of leaks comes from disaffected insiders, bureaucrats or political appointees wishing to influence debate or expose blunders within their own agencies. And then there's a third variety, the vanity leak.
And that is that somebody has this information and just can't keep quiet about it and wants to talk about it as a way of basically showing off.
Reporters need to understand those various motivations in order to evaluate the substance of a given leak. But mainly, they're concerned with the steady flow of reliable information. Bill Gertz is on the national security beat at the Washington Times. So successful has he been in reporting classified information that he is said to be the main target of so-called official secrets legislation now percolating in Congress.
You know, as we say in the news business, you're only as good as your sources. So we focus quite a bit on being able to circumvent the official public affairs bureaucracy.
If that sounds like a perverse game, that's because it's a perverse game whose perversity is rooted in the fact that official spokesmen mouth the carefully parsed pronouncements of politicians who are worried about political consequences and therefore cannot be relied upon on any subject, including the weather. Even Leon Firth, the Clinton White House's Mr. Tightlips, acknowledges the credibility gap.
Dating back to Vietnam and Watergate, the press has had its reasons to be cynical about the motivations of government in wanting to keep information secret.
Even now, in the enlightened and transparent 21st century, the executive branch tends toward willy-nilly classification of innocuous information that properly belongs in the public domain. And when confronted by media organizations with leaked information for confirmation or comment, official Washington often reacts with reflexive cries of national security. This often leaves media organizations with difficult choices. When asked to kill or alter a story, they have to decide, is it really a matter of protecting military or intelligence personnel in the field? Or is the government just trying to shield itself from embarrassment or political fallout? And if the story is held, will it show up the next day in the competition, maybe with a spin favorable to the government? The Washington Times' Bill Gertz.
I can remember in one case we had a story about a CIA officer who was having an affair with an Eastern European intelligence officer, and the CIA had asked that we not publish it, and we didn't. And within a week, the story came out in another news publication.
Some leaks, of course, are well tolerated by administrations because the administration itself, for political or diplomatic reasons, has engineered the leak. Journalist Scott Armstrong.
If you can control the information and you leak it out selectively, you can control the press and you can control the public debate. That's the idea.
Divining what is strategic and what is actually a breach is all part of the game. 2 weeks ago in the Washington Post, reporter Bob Woodward had an exquisitely detailed story about attempts during the Clinton administration to capture Osama bin Laden. Attempts, according to the Woodward account, that were squelched by Saudi Arabia's refusal to participate. For leakologists, this was an irresistible brain teaser. Was the source old Clintonites? Democrats on the Hill? The Bush White House? Who? Armstrong, who was the co-author with Woodward on the bestseller The Brethren, has his own suspicions. They begin with Saudi diplomat Prince Bandar.
Anyone who's read Woodward's books that deal with the Persian Gulf War would have noted that there are a lot of quote marks around things that Prince Bandar has said. And when somebody tells me that the U.S. wanted to do something with Saudi Arabia, and I know that the principal line of communication throughout the entire period was through Prince Bandar to the Saudi government and back through Prince Bandar to the United States government, I put those two things together and come up with the most likely source of this information is a Saudi.
Leon Firth, for his part, doesn't much care who the source was. Nowadays, he's a visiting professor of international relations at George Washington University, but when he read the piece, his instinct was still to fear for the flock.
Let's say that the information that he reported is correct for the sake of talk, for the sake of discussion. Let's just say that it's correct. Then that would be damaging, because it would talk about, by implication, networks that we used, relationships that we had developed, kinds of influence that we could exercise, and our mode of planning an attack. And I recognize the press has got a problem because there's an infinite requirement for information and for visual images, but the country has a need. Now, is it the government's problem to solve this, or is it the press's problem to figure out how to deal with it?
It's a conundrum, all right. But one answer might be to look elsewhere in the world, where nobody dare leak, and nobody dare publish, and nobody knows what obscenity the regime is up to next. The citizens' protection is the responsibility of any government. Protection from the national government by a vigilant press and its confederates is a unique blessing of democracy. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Chris Sakis, Rob Christensen, and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh and Andy Lancet. Our web mistress is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.